Hello, everybody. How are you? Welcome to another episode of Causes or Cures. I am your host, Dr. Eeks. Thanks for being here. I hope your 2022 is off to an okay start. If it's not, I hope it gets better. If neither of those two things are going to happen, you know, just think positive. Think positive. I'm the last person who should talk about thinking positive, but I hear it helps. Anyhow, in today's episode, my guest is Dr. Ariel Israel. He is an MD, a PhD. He heads one of the large research institutes in Israel, and he specializes in data mining, analytics, bioinformatics, and machine learning. He has been doing a lot of studies during COVID-19, and I've interviewed him before for Trial Site News, and he's done studies on antibody decay after COVID vaccines versus antibody decay after a naturally acquired infection. What does that comparison look like? He's done studies on early drugs, supplements that may lower the risk of getting COVID-19 or severity of infection, and those studies are all online. They're interesting. Take a look at them. I mean, there's a lot of interest in early treatment, and I think his research on that is really good because Israel has such good data collection systems, and they can figure this stuff out pretty fast. But today, he is going to talk about his new research. Now, this has been published in on a preprint server. I know this is like the era of where we all run with preprints. And so just so you know, it hasn't been peer reviewed. It's not written in stone. Don't run with it, you know, but it's interesting. I say we always like, everybody, so if you're on Twitter, you'll see everybody like cherry picks preprints and run with them to defend some position related to COVID-19. Anyhow, for this particular study, he and his team developed a COVID calculator, which anyone can access as a web-based app. And I will post the link to that app in the podcast description so you could try it out if you want. Basically, it can predict whether or not you will be hospitalized with COVID-19 or die from it if you are infected. Now, yes, this seems very morbid, and why would you want to do that? Well, it's interesting. I played around with it. I put in my numbers and got out my risk factors. You know, if you're like a super anxious person or a nervous person, you may not want to do this. But it basically uses commonly known risk factors and comorbidities and gives you a risk, right, for hospitalization and death. So it's interesting if you want to try it. But again, don't run with it, and don't let it give you an anxiety attack. That's not the purpose. The purpose of something like this would be, okay, to know your risk, sure, but also maybe like if you're a hospital or a public health person, you know, who to allocate certain resources to if you have limited resources. Anyhow, in addition to talking about that calculator and various risk factors and what a person's risk might be for hospitalization or death, he's going to talk about the situation in Israel right now. What wave are they on? What's going on with the vaccines? He's also going to talk about vaccine side effects, particularly how Israel analyzes vaccine safety versus the United States, because it's different. It's really different. And since there's so much chatter about that, I thought we should talk about that too. All right, that said, let's connect to Dr. Israel in Israel.
Okay, so Dr. Ariel Israel, it's always a pleasure to chat with you. And we're going to talk about your new research today that's in preprint. So we can't run with it as proof of anything, but it's really interesting. And right off the bat, just so our listeners know, it's called COVID-19 Severity Prediction Based on Patient Risk Factors and Number of Vaccines Received. So before this podcast, I was calculating my own risk of hospitalization and death, and playing around with it. I'm going to send it to my friends. But anyhow, let's start out. How is Israel doing right now with the COVID situation?
So right now, it's really, we are in front of a new wave. I think the Omicron reached Israel, and we had yesterday, I think, about more than 20,000 new infections, which for a country of about 8 million people, it's a lot. I have five children, and two of my children had had a few of their fellow school pupils who were positive. So I had today to take each one to do a rapid antigen test. So I think many people are staying at home now because they have one person in who's been infected in the family.
Oh no! And I read this morning, there's you guys are rolling out now a fourth shot for everyone over 60. Is that right?
It's quite experimental, I must say.
That's I don't mean to laugh.
We saw that it's not harming, and I think we are before the FDA on this one. But it was the same, I think, for the third.
I mean, because you were looking good there for a little bit after the third.
Yeah. Okay. I must say that the Omicron is something new. It's apparently we can't say for now what's the impact of vaccination. Surely that vaccination will help to prevent the severe cases. Mm-hmm. But in terms of only infection, you know, the vaccine being able to block the virus to the point that people do not get infected at all, I'm not sure that we are there. You know, there are many people who are infected despite they've been vaccinated.
Right. And we're having the same issue over here. And Dr. Fauci said we should stop focusing on the increase in cases and focus more on hospitalization rates and death rates, you know, subsequent to that. But I know people don't agree on that.
It makes sense. You know, what we want to avoid is the severe cases. It's the
severe cases,
and of course, death. So if we're able to prevent that, and it's you know, like a flu, and people get out of it, I think this is an achievement.
And we might, and no one can talk about naturally acquired immunity or infection acquired immunity without sounding like a sociopath. Like everybody's always like careful with their words.
I think that we are getting natural immunity by getting infected once you've got the protection of the vaccine, because the vaccine is protecting, I think, from you know, the very harmful infection. Mm-hmm. And at the moment you are already vaccinated and you are exposed to a virus strain that is slightly different than the one that is included in the vaccine, then people do get infection. Mm-hmm. And I think that because this infection is not very, you know, severe, they get some kind of a natural booster. That's what I see when I look at the curve of the, I did a study in which we've looked for the antibodies with time elapsing from the vaccine. And we saw that there is a very rapid decrease, about 40% every month, in the titer of the vaccine. But interestingly, when you've got, you know, a very steep curve at the beginning, you begin to see after a few months that there is an increase, even an increase. And I think that's because of silent infections. People who are vaccinated get some kind of natural booster. And that's why after a few months, you observe in part of them an increase in the antibodies. Mm. They probably get, you know, some kind of a natural boosting by getting exposed to the real virus. Most of them are not even aware, mm-hmm. but we can see that in the fact that the antibodies is slightly raising.
I mean, and are you familiar with the movie The Wizard of Oz? With, you know, yeah. Like the yellow, yeah. The yellow brick road. Like that's what I think about, the yellow brick road, like on the way to herd immunity. And I'm always saying, okay, when are we going to reach herd immunity? Which, you know, would be sort of like the wizard in the castle. Cause people thought.
There are people saying that the Omicron. Yeah, there are people saying that the Omicron is the path to natural immunity. Okay, because it's apparently a very infective strain, mm-hmm. but on the other hand, it is probably not as harmful than the previous strains. So maybe it's something that we can get exposed to and not be too concerned about, especially if you're vaccinated, about having a severe
disease. It might just run through us.
So maybe that's the path for herd immunity, okay. Getting exposed to some kind of, how would you say that? What we've got, you know, we've got the vaccine for varicella and the vaccine for, many of the vaccines for viruses, it's from a strain that is, it's a virus, but mm-hmm. It's less harmful.
Less harmful, right?
Yeah. So that's what we've got in part of in the vaccines that are given in the first year of life. Maybe the Omicron is kind of that, but I will not recommend anybody to get exposed to Omicron without getting the vaccine beforehand.
No, and that's why I was saying you have to be so careful how you talk about this topic, because you just consider the potential that it runs through people. And you're not suggesting, oh, well, I hope it infects, you could come out with herd immunity at the end, hopefully this time around. So let's talk about Israel, and you in particular, you've done a lot of research during this pandemic. I always say the United States should be thanking Israel for doing all our homework, because you guys always come out with the studies first. So let's talk a little bit about, well, you know, just remind people who you are and, or, you know, introduce yourself to people who may not know who you are, and then we can jump into your latest study.
Thank you. So my name is Ariel Israel. I'm a family doctor, a specialist in family medicine. I also have a PhD in bioinformatics and human genetics, and I'm head of the Research Institute of Leumit, which is one of the four national HMOs we've got in Israel. And as part of our ongoing research, we are looking at the effect of vaccines and how we can improve health in our population. And now we've just received the shipment of Paxlovid, the new Pfizer medication for COVID, and we've been trying to find the best way to give this medication to our in series. We do not have a lot of this medication, so we've got to be careful to give it to the right people so that it will save lives and not be wasted, and people will have a benign course of the disease anyway. So what we've been doing is that we've collected all the information we have about people who got infected with COVID since the beginning of the pandemic. And we tried to build a model which will predict according to any individual baseline parameters, is demographic, is comorbidities, is lab measurements, if we can predict which of people who get infected will eventually get hospitalized and or even die of the disease. So in our health organization, we've got above 100,000 patients for which we have evidence of COVID infection, positive PCR, and we know exactly who got hospitalized, and we know who died of the disease. And we also have electronic health records in which we've got a very comprehensive information about our injuries. Of course, lab measures, BMI, comorbidities. So we try to use all this information to build a model who could predict as best as possible who will get a severe disease. And we found out that with very few parameters, we are able to predict with very high accuracy at the beginning of the disease, who is going to have a severe course and who is going to die. So that's what we published in this paper, in this manuscript, which is now a preprint. Mm-hmm. And we also built a calculator so that anybody could enter his own parameters or the parameter of the patient of his and know exactly what's the probability. We use it here in our health organization to find who are the patients who are at risk and will get the medicine.
Yeah, maybe someone who has a lot of comorbidities shouldn't use the calculator if they find out that they have.
So
they'll get a lot of anxiety.
So first, it's something that is once a person got already infected.
Right.
And we know that the vaccine is protecting us about first from infection. What's interesting is that the most important factor is age.
Age, right.
It's by far the most important factor. And then we know that having reduced renal function will increase the risk of the disease, and it depends on what's the stage of the kidney disease. Also, elevated BMI, elevated blood glucose, what we call hemoglobin A1C, and very few comorbidities that we found was determinant. It's a pulmonary disease. It's hypertension, mm-hmm. and it's malignancy. So
can we go back to age? Just go back to age, because I think.
Yeah.
So with age, from your paper, each year increases your odds for hospitalization by a factor of 1.0581. Is that right?
Yeah.
So that means, so if you're 20 and you have the same underlying risk factors or similar as a 60-year-old, the 60-year-old is still 10 times more likely to get hospitalized. How about, and then you also had a separate model for death too, but I know the calculator calculates them both at the same time. So how much more likely are you to die?
So age has even a more important impact on the risk of mortality than on the risk of hospitalization. Mm. It's a very strong impact. And it's something interesting that must be investigated. What's really in age is increasing so strongly the risk of severe disease, but it's apparently one of the most important factors, more important than comorbidities. So comorbidities, we find that after we adjust for the age, they have a slight effect. But as you said, if you multiply by every year by 1.05, I don't remember exactly the coefficient, then it's very rapidly increasing. It's exponential increase.
Oh wow! Here it is. So I said it was 10 times more likely if you're 60 to be hospitalized than if you're 20.
It's about 35. Yeah. It's a,
well, you're 51 times more likely to die. Wow.
Yeah. 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 And you didn't give the figure for 80, and I prefer you not to, because otherwise,
that's depressing.
It's quite concerning. That's the reason why we give the medication in priority to aged persons, because they are most at risk. Mm-hmm. And it's something that you will see that getting the vaccinations, you can even calculate the impact of getting two vaccine doses and three vaccine doses mitigate the risk significantly, but yet it's still quite high for people who are about the age of 80. And for these people, I think the medication will really help.
How much did the vaccine mitigate the risk for hospitalization and mortality in as it relates to age?
It's the same factor regardless of the age. So you take the risk that you calculate according to the risk factors, and the age is one of the major risk factors. And then you add having three injections or unvaccinated, it's about a third. The risk is decreased by about 70% for hospitalization, and even more, I think, by 77%. For death, for people who received three vaccines. And
three
something
vaccines.
That was very interesting is in contrast to the effect of vaccination on the risk for getting infected, which is decreasing with time that has elapsed since the vaccine, we did not see this effect in for the prevention of severe disease. People who've got two doses, even if it's 10 months ago, we are still seeing the protective effect, and the real protective effect is seen with three doses, three injections.
Okay, so you did not find the time elapsed since vaccination significantly
decrease the vaccination protection.
Okay.
So
for hospitalization.
For hospitalization. So we are talking about people who have already the virus. They have a positive PCR test.
Mm-hmm.
And then the effect of the vaccine does not seem to wane on the protection from for the risk for severe disease.
For hospitalizations.
Hospitalization, and even more for death.
And for death. So who should get the third shot then? Like, why are we just, how does that recommendation play into that statistic?
So obviously, the more people are at risk, the more they need the third vaccine. Because a person who has a risk of above 10% for hospitalization, and I don't want to give figures about for death, you really want to protect for that. People who anyway got lower risk for hospitalization and for death, it's less urgent. They will get the same benefit in terms of the reduction of risk, but the risk is already low. So if you've got a few vaccine doses to give to your population, then obviously you need to protect first the person who are most at risk.
So say kids, for example, would giving kids a third dose really offer a significant?
It gives the same protection in terms of of reducing the risk, but if it's already low, it will get lower, but
okay.
It depends.
But
if
do you
got
need
enough,
it?
If you've got enough vaccines to vaccinate all the population, then you can vaccine. You can give the third dose to children, and it will further reduce the risk. But they are not to give the vaccine in priority. I've my children has got three vaccines. So
they have three vaccines.
Because in Israel we've got enough, and my two children who are above 12 were already vaccinated 5 months ago. So now they can receive the third vaccine and they've received it.
So you're not concerned at all about myocarditis? Is that a concern?
No, it's not. It's really not a concern. There are studies that have really quantified the risk for myocarditis and pericarditis, which are rare complications of the vaccine. And they found that first, all the cases were mild cases of myocarditis and pericarditis. It's not the severe cases. Not any case in Israel has led to the need for heart transplantation. There are very mild cases that are self-limiting, that, you know, after a few...
Sorry, I forgot to turn my microphone on there. Can I ask you about that word mild? You know, people say the word mild a lot. Mild?
Yeah.
And you just said they weren't required to get a heart transplantation. Now that to me is like on the far end of the spectrum.
When people talk about myocarditis, that's the main concern. That's the fact that the myocarditis will damage the heart to the point that it will not work anymore. Okay, that's the really bad case of myocarditis.
That would be catastrophic if you're a young kid.
Yeah, the one.
Okay,
exactly.
So same kid.
Said is that there are no cases like that.
Okay.
There are no cases like that.
But what are the cases?
Because myocarditis is a name for inflammation of the myocard, which is the
heart muscle.
The heart muscle. And you have the different degrees of inflammation, and the inflammation that we find following the vaccine is mild in terms of it goes away.
So say
it's not something that is staying.
It's not staying. But it could interrupt your life, maybe. Like if I'm 11 years old and I play soccer, do you call it football or soccer in Israel?
But it means football.
All right, it's football. So he plays football. So let's say he gets this case, and I know there it's a rare side effect, at least after the two doses, I think at least over here they're still trying to figure this out. But so he gets a case of myocarditis from after the vaccine, and it's mild. What does that mean? Can he go to soccer practice in a week, or does he have to?
I must say I'm not a pediatrician, and I'm not even I don't know the figures well.
Okay.
But what I can say about what I know is that. He probably will not be able to play soccer when he has the disease, but it's a few weeks and it will go away. And then when his heart goes back to normal, he would be able to play soccer. I don't think it's recommended to play soccer when you've got myocarditis. But when it goes away, he will go back to play soccer. And overall, myocarditis is a complication of the virus, and it happens more among people who got infected from the virus than for people who got the vaccine. It's about 10 times less for people who got the vaccine than people who got infected. At any age, yes.
Okay.
And eventually, I think, everybody will catch COVID, okay? Especially those who are not vaccinated. So I think it's better if you got to choose to get the risk of myocarditis that is associated with the vaccine, which is quite low, than the risk of myocarditis which is associated with the disease.
But my sister is a pediatrician in Pennsylvania, and she has seen more cases of myocarditis related to the virus. But you know, my family runs the gamut of views on the vaccine and COVID and that kind of thing. But I do remember her saying that. I wanted, could you tell people, and I know you told me this before, but I think it's, it would be interesting for Americans to know this. You, in Israel, there's no vaccine adverse event reporting system. You just, right? You just kind of collect everything. Could you just explain how that works?
Yeah, because, I will explain to you because yeah, it's not something that you're used to see. We've got electronic health records. So it means that when you go see a doctor in any of the four health organizations that is in Israel, you will have a computer and it will be connected to a central electronic health records in which everything is documented. Not only adverse event for the vaccine, but it will everything that is documenting for a patient, it will write it down, and it will use codification for everything he's writing. So we're using ICD-9 codes, and for instance, myocarditis is codified. Using the same code. And what we can see is compare the frequency of patients who get this code, myocarditis, and who were vaccinated, and the control population of a person who were not vaccinated. And myocarditis is just an example. In fact, we can look at any diagnosis code and look for statistical enrichment among people who got the vaccine or even among people who got the virus. And then we run statistical tests and we can say whether it's statistically significant and what's the rate of this any complication. In contrast to what I think you're doing in the US, when you go to the physician, he must think that it's an adverse event. And it's really something subjective because your sister has seen, I don't know, 5-6 cases of myocarditis among the people who got, I don't know.
It's controversial,
one person can see only a few cases.
Oh, of course,
yes. And it's very subjective whether you think it's associated to the vaccine or it's associated to the disease, because you will see people can get myocarditis even without getting the vaccine and without getting COVID. It's something that happens. And this goes for any possible complication. And when you've got, you know, half of the population who is getting a vaccine at the same time, many will go to the doctor with normal complaints, and then it's very difficult for a single person to decide whether this complaint is associated with the vaccine or it's just the normal kind of complaints that you see in the population. The only way you can prove whether it's something that is associated to the vaccine or not is just taking all the cases together, run a statistical test, and see whether you see a statistically significant difference compared to a control population. So that's what we do in Israel. And so we do not have to decide beforehand whether when you see someone complaining of something, it's a complication of the vaccine or not. It just entered like everything you document when there is a patient encounter, and then we can just count them and run statistical tests and see whether any possible diagnosis is more present, statistically more present in the population of vaccinated rather than not. And I think that was the reason, the fact that we've got such an advanced electronic health record in our health organization was one of the reasons Israel was selected to be one of the first countries to get the vaccine, because we are able to track very effectively any possible complication of the vaccine.
Are you guys still only using Pfizer, or are you expanding?
So we are mostly using Pfizer. There are very few persons who get the other vaccines, but it's really a minority. It's very few in the population who get the other ones. Those who want to have the other vaccines are able to get them.
Okay. Can we talk more about the comorbidities used in your model? And we can include BMI as comorbidity, high BMI. I know there's issues with the BMI and it's not entirely accurate, but at the population level, it's a good screening tool. I know there's more accurate ways to assess somebody's fat composition. Just throwing that out there. It's not perfect. So in terms of a comorbidity that is most likely or more likely than, you know, the others to put you at an increased risk of being hospitalized with COVID or dying from COVID, how would you rank them?
So I just opened the paper so that I will give you the accurate numbers.
Okay.
So what we found is that first, it's not only BMI, and you're right. The problem is BMI. BMI is a ratio of body mass in kilograms divided by the height that we put in square, because we are not single dimensional. But you write that a person who is very muscular is expected to can have a high BMI even though he's he doesn't have a lot of fat,
right?
It's a lot of fat. So that's the reason we found that it's a BMI in conjunction with hemoglobin A1C, which is diabetes. And many times, a person with obese over time will develop some kind of glucose intolerance, and his hemoglobin A1C will go high. So what we found, if you look at the BMI, is that in terms of the risk for hospitalization, it's multiplied by about 3 for people who have BMI above 35, which is severe obesity. Those who are between 30 and 35, it's multiplied by 1.66. So it's after, you know, you counted the effect of the age and the other risk factors. If you've got two persons, one was a BMI above 35 and one was BMI normal. So the one who has BMI above 35, will have the risk multiplied by 2.9. And for mortality, it's even more moderate. Interestingly, people who are underweight, below 18.5, have also elevated risk for mortality.
That's important, because
So it's not too healthy to be underweight, and
moderation once again,
especially those who've got also some kind of impaired kidney function. So it's the best is to have a normal BMI or even slightly above normal, but not too high and not too low.
Right. But how is your obesity issue in Israel? Ours is pretty significant over here.
Yeah, we've got a significant issue with obesity. I think it's getting more severe even in the last 2 years.
Oh yeah.
Because of the confinements, people did not exercise, and so it's a real issue. It's also an issue of healthy foods. You know, children are getting sugar drinks and are eating not healthy, and it's really an issue. And it's a problem in Israel. I think it's a problem in every country, and it's also a problem in Israel.
Yeah, it seems to be. We have to wrap our heads around it somehow. Because I know over here, we declared obesity an epidemic. I want to say in the late 1990s, and that we just keep going up. So
it's one of your habits that unfortunately we also adopted. I think it's something that we need to take care about.
Yeah,
and if this pandemic is causing people to move a little because they want to reduce their risk. We mm-hmm. also found out that exercising is also protecting. We've got a questionnaire, and sometimes the physician will mark whether a person is doing physical exercise. And we found that doing physical exercise has a protective effect.
At any weight?
At any weight. After you account for the BMI,
okay.
People who exercise have lower risk than people who do not exercise.
Okay. And I'm just looking at this. I wrote this down. So actually, if you're underweight, your risk of death is a little higher than if you're obese. Huh.
Yeah.
A little bit.
Yeah, it's very difficult to tell exactly from these figures in what context this happens. Because sometimes it may happen, you know, for very aged people who are at a wasting state. Not only they have degraded. So I think that's probably what gave this very high coefficient.
I see.
The fact that that you've got people who are quite sick, and being underweight is usually a sign of
you mm-hmm. know, like a you have to figure out the chicken or egg type of thing, yeah. Right now. Can you talk a little bit about differences between male and female?
Yeah, interestingly, females have reduced risk compared to male. It's very difficult to tell exactly about what's it about. We know that women usually live longer than men. So probably there is something genetic, some mechanism which make that. For the same age, women will have lesser risk of having severe disease.
Something going for the ladies. biological sex.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Accurate model.
Yeah.
And this calculator is available publicly to use at covidest.web.app. Now, is this available to the public? Are you just going to leave it up there? And
so you can use it. There is a disclaimer saying that it's given with no guarantee. So you mm-hmm. use it at your own responsibility. And I'm not sure how useful it is for the layperson. He can look at that, but I think it's more useful, I think, for clinicians who get who must decide who of their patients are most at risk and decide what treatment to give accordingly.
Mm.
And I think these are the people for which we think this calculator would be the most useful.
I understand that, and public health people who are,
exactly.
you know, making decisions. But I will say, if it's available publicly, lay people are definitely going to use it.
they can. understand what's the GFR, you know, the kidney function, be able to put some value there. But if they understand the concepts,
but they know if they might just put normal. I have no issues with the GFR.
Okay, yeah. So, but it must be accurate. So
okay.
Yeah. Mm.
It's interesting. One final question, and I know I sent you. You know, we just there's a group of doctors over here who just submitted an emergency use application for fluvoxamine to be used for COVID-19 as early treatment. You mentioned that you're just starting to use the Pfizer's antiviral as early treatment. Are you guys using anything else?
So I recommended last time, you know, vitamin D and coenzyme Q.
Coenzyme Q.
And I think we've got some signals that not only fluvoxamine, but a few SSRIs have a slight protective effect. Fluvoxamine was not very much used, so we do not have. So it's probable that fluvoxamine has a positive effect. And if you do not have access to you know, the best medication, or a person who could not afford it, it's definitely an option. I think the most effective medication I've seen so far is vitamin D and coenzyme Q, and that's something that I recommend to anybody.
I actually mentioned coenzyme Q to this woman who works at the bar. Not that I go to the bar all the time, but I told her she could take it. And how many milligrams? I know we said last time the brand doesn't matter. It's, you know, lots of brands sell it, but do you know how many milligrams it was?
So usually people are taking about 100 milligrams. Okay. Or micrograms. It's a very safe product. It's a food supplement, so I don't think that there is any problem taking 200. So anything between 100 and 200 and even more, it's okay.
You're not gonna die.
Well, usually, what we found that people who are taking this food supplement because they are. They are taking statins,
right.
have a really protective effect. And I recommend to take it at the usual dose that is taken by people who take statins. It's about 100 milligrams a day.
I see. And you said maybe people in Israel who are taking the antidepressants, the SSRIs, do they have a protective effect?
Yeah, they've got
that's it.
But okay. Of course, you're not going to take a SSRI.
No, no.
Just...
yeah, no, so, definitely not.
So, yeah. So, yeah, but people who take a SSRI, it's another good reason to continue the treatment. Yeah.
Okay.
Let's stop it.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Israel. As always, it's good to chat with you. Very informative. And I plan on sharing this paper and your calculator and getting it out there into the US and beyond.
Thank
very
you.
Interesting.
Thank
yeah.
You.
And good luck and with everything.
I hope everybody will have a safe fifth wave because it's really.
Fourth wave or fifth? You're on your fourth.
we do not know how to count a safe Omicron wave
I read about a new variant on Twitter. I just ignored it though. I'm like I'm not in the mood to see that. Everybody, I'm in New York City and everybody here has COVID. So it's just like the lines outside the city MD, you'd think they're like, you know, a store having a hot sale. Yeah,
we've
it's crazy.
The same here. We have got very big lines in front of places in which you get tested.
Yeah.
So have a safe Omicron wave.
You too. All right. And thanks again. And I'll hopefully chat to you. If you get more research, just let me know. And
thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
You too.
Bye.
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 All right, guys, thanks so much for listening. I hope you stick around. I hope you subscribe. I hope you share it. And if you have any ideas for guests, let me know. You know, I told you to think positive at the beginning of this podcast. I'm going to reemphasize that here. Think positive. Not all of us are as lucky as the man of La Mancha. You know, he had his delusions and he was always dreaming the impossible dream and fighting the impossible fight, doing impossible stuff. That was the whole point of that. And having delusions of grandeur. And sometimes in medicine and that kind of thing, they're like delusions or, you know, they're like bad or scary. And sometimes I'm like, man, you know, I think we need some more delusions out here. Some good delusions, like Man of La Mancha stuff, and then we'd be a lot happier. And Or maybe we just need to exercise our imagination more. Maybe it's not even a delusion. People just need to work out their imagination. You know, at the gym, you have like leg day, arm day, abs. You should have imagination day, because, man, some people's imaginations are just, it's not even there. It's like not even part of their brain. What a way to go through life. But I digress. Anyhow, see you soon next time. Okay. Hang in there. Do good things, believe in good things. Do something good for somebody else. That's what it's all about. All right. I'm going to go for a run now, because obviously I am too philosophical, and if I stay on this thing, my Irish brain will just go on and on and on and on forever, and nobody wants to hear that. All right, guys. Bye-bye.